We're speaking with sociologist Tressie McMillan Cottom about for-profit colleges like Kaplan, Strayer, ITT Tech, and others. You know them. She'll help us explore whether they are helping to reduce social inequalities by expanding access to higher education, or whether they present yet another obstacle to education justice in the United States. Also joining us later in the program, photographer and social activist Carlton Mackey will discuss his latest creative project, 50 Shades of Black. It's a visual discourse on black sex symbols and the politics of skin color. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. And in the meantime, we are listening for those phones to ring and for those pledges to roll in. This is Sisters Time.
May be wondering what is going to happen now. It is, of course, necessary for the minds and souls of us all.
Welcome back to Sisters Time. I'm Kalia Saramen. A few months ago, Harvard University released a study on what's called the for-profit post-secondary school sector, also known as for-profit colleges. I thought their findings about the rise of for-profit franchises and online programs were really quite interesting, especially in terms of this revived national conversation around student loan debt. And, of course, the disproportionate burden of that debt is held by students at for-profit colleges. Now, the report doesn't spend much time on the racial dimensions of the for-profit college landscape, so to help us navigate these concerns in particular, I have enlisted Tressie McMillan Cottom. Welcome, Tressie.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tressie is a local blogger on education policy and issues, and she is a sociologist interested in power in institutions. Her current research agenda tackles questions of inequality and stratification by asking, why are 1 in 10 black college students, many of them poor, low income, and first generation, why are they now enrolled in for-profit colleges? Mm-hmm. So I have the pleasure of talking with her today about this important question on race and access to higher education. So welcome again.
Thank you very much. A tall order you've given me, by the way. If we
cover everything. If you couldn't handle it, I wouldn't give it to you.
Okay.
Now, I first took notice of your fascinating blog when a particular post of yours basically went viral in the blogosphere.
Yeah.
You had some stiff words for a certain self-styled intellectual who was very critical of black studies and its validity within higher education. So I thought maybe we could start there if you could just very briefly tell us what you were trying to communicate in that piece, because I think this attempt to marginalize black studies is not only evidence of the continuing marginalization of people of color in higher education, but I also sense that this kind of attitude has served as an impetus for your research agenda.
Well, thank you. Actually, that is a wonderful connection to make, and so thank you for making it. Sometimes I think people think that I have my hands in a lot of different pots, and to me they all seem like one pot, which is I am very concerned about and always pay a great deal of attention to the ways in which we talk about people that I happen to care about. So to me that's all one issue, so thank you for framing it that way, because that's absolutely the way that I tend to look at that. So, yeah, so, you know, this is not a new issue. I think as long as we have had the inclusion of people of color in higher education and in the academy, there have been issues about whether or not we belong, and if we do belong, how we need to perform to prove that we belong, and that there's this ongoing conversation about what is a legitimate course of research, what types of questions we should be concerned about to be made to feel welcome or to be considered legitimate or serious scholars, right? This is not, again, not a new question. It was just a new way of framing it for a slightly different audience, perhaps, but this has been an ongoing conversation. You can look at this historically, and you can see that as soon as people of color were admitted to higher education, there have been these tensions. So one of the most recent iterations of that was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is not the type of newspaper, you know, most of us read, which is actually fine, I'm going to say. But it is the paper of those of us who do this for a living, right? So mm-hmm. If you work at a college or university, or you plan on working in one, or you do research in one, as I do as a graduate student, then this is the paper that you read to kind of stay abreast of what's going on in your industry, right? I lose track of time. This is, what, 2 or 3 months ago, I suppose, now this happened. There was a very interesting article in which she proclaimed, I don't think I'm mischaracterizing anyone. I believe she would consider herself a right-leaning pundit or critic, cultural critic. Took aim at the legitimacy of black studies programs and graduate students who are in a black studies program, and she questioned whether or not the field should even exist, whether it was a legitimate field of study.
That's awfully bold.
Well, yeah, bold again, though, but not rare. I mean, you know, this is not, I mean, while it doesn't always make sort of, you know, the regular news, and it's not something that people tend to think about every day, for those of us who do this, this is not unheard of. So it is bold, but not particularly, you know, novel.
And you issued a very direct and well-articulated response that picked up a lot of attention, and ultimately your outspokenness resulted in that woman being asked to resign from her role with the Chronicle.
This is true, yes, although I'm reticent to take full responsibility for that, just in case there's such a thing called karma. But I will say that I thought it was fair. I don't think that she, I always want to clarify this point, because very often, you know, I was, as much as people supported the call, which I was very, very grateful for, I did receive a great deal of support from people. There were people who were very critical. You know, I've been charged with, you know, the thought police, reverse racism, sort of the normal.
For defending the right of black studies to exist.
Right.
Let's be very clear.
And for defending the right for us to exist without being attacked in what is essentially our industry newspaper. You know, there is a legitimate way to have that kind of conversation. We have sort of rules about these things, you know. There's the proper way to discuss whether or not someone's work is well-written or well-researched, but questioning whether or not they even have the right to ask the question is an entirely different issue. And that was her position, right, that you don't get to speak about blackness in a way that is just about black people or black interests. That's not legitimate. Right, that, you know, her position is we have Barack Obama now, which is, I don't know, a response that many people have to many things, but I did not think that it was probably an adequate response to this.
Mm-hmm.
I did think that we probably deserved more from a newspaper that professes to represent all of higher education. If you're going to be the newspaper perhaps of conservative higher education or conservatives in higher education, then that's one thing. But that is not what this paper is. So one of the things that I did call for and that I hope that I walk the talk is, you know, we have as much right to be here as anyone else. And as such, I demand of the institution to represent me as much as it wants me to represent it in a way that it defines. We get the right to define, to say to the institution, well, I'm here too, so you also need to represent me.
Very well said. Very well
Thanks.
Said. Please continue to overturn those stones, all of the things that we like to keep in the dark, in the back, underneath you are revealing them. Now, your current research is needling in on for-profit higher mm-hmm. education and its effects on wider social disparities. So let's mm-hmm. jump right in.
Okay.
According to this very same Chronicle of Higher Education, mm-hmm. the number of for-profit post-secondary institutions has nearly doubled in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. Their revenues are expanding, and a disproportionate share of their students enjoys public federal aid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are for-profit colleges exactly, and should we be excited that they are proliferating?
Ooh. Okay, so I'm going to take the first question first. That's the safest place to begin. So for-profit colleges, when we think of what are for-profit colleges, it's sometimes easier to talk about what they are not, right? So in our general imagination, we think of college as a place that young adults, after high school, go away to a state public college or a private college somewhere. You live on campus, you attend for a couple of semesters or four quarters a year, and after 4 years, hopefully 4 to 6 or so years, you come out with a college degree. That is what we tend to think of as college. In contrast, what for-profit colleges are is they tend not to be residential colleges. They are not places that generally one goes to and for instance, lives on campus, right? So it is structured somewhat differently than traditional college. But I think the primary difference is why they exist. So traditional colleges, which is how I'll refer to them in the literature, we call them all kinds of things, not-for-profit, public. But I'll just say traditional colleges, what we tend to think of as college, does not exist to generate a profit. Yes, traditional colleges do raise a lot of money. People think about the sports programs, you know, Duke, Carolina, UGA, the sports programs are huge, and yes, they do generate a lot of money. But by designation with the IRS, traditional colleges do not operate to make money to then pay out as profit to the people who own the college, because in a public college, the people own it. You know, it was chartered by the state, and in a private college, it's generally a board. But you don't run the college to try to generate a profit.
That is then distributed to, say, shareholders.
Exactly.
As a corporation would be.
That is correct. For all intents and purposes, you can think of a for-profit's organizational structure as being like that of any other private business, a private hospital, a private retailer. It operates to generate profit for the people who own it.
And education, not only that,
yeah.
It seems, you know, within this strict economic definition,
mm-hmm.
To provide a service to
that's
its
right.
customers.
That is correct.
Not students per se.
That's right. Education is the product. It is not the reason why it exists. By contrast, it's not chartered or founded to, for instance, educate the general public. It exists to generate the profit. The product that it sells is education. And so it is a different orientation. What I would say the motivation for the organization existing is just fundamentally different.
And so what are the implications of that difference in terms of the experiences
mm-hmm.
and the learning outcomes
mm-hmm.
of students?
Well, I mean, I will be fair. I think it depends on what side of the issue you tend to fall on this. So those who support for-profit colleges would say, they provide greater opportunity and access to people who would not have traditionally chosen to go to college, right? So one way of framing this is people say the people who tend to enroll in for-profit colleges like the University of Phoenix or here locally, Troy University is very popular, that they aren't choosing between Troy and the University of Georgia. They are choosing between Troy and no college at all. Right.
Mm.
And so by Troy existing, it is providing another point of access for people. Now, on the other side of that is the debate about at what cost, at what expense, to whom, and whether or not the outcomes justify the expense. For-profit colleges tend to be dramatically more expensive than comparable programs at traditional colleges.
Can you, on what order of magnitude? Can you give us a sense?
Actually, I believe that I can. Let's see. So if we're talking about per year at the average public institution, inclusive of room and board, right, I want to make this, because I was just making this point earlier today, this is very important. Tuition, room and board, so a place to stay, some place to eat, you eat in the CAF, you might get some health insurance through student health or the infirmary services, will run you about $17,000 to $19,000 per year at a public college. In contrast, 1 year in a bachelor's degree granting program at, say, ITT Tech or University of Phoenix will run you between $20,000 and $25,000 a year for tuition and books and fees.
That's up to $10,000, my goodness.
Yes. And the price disparity becomes greater when you're talking about community colleges versus for-profit colleges that offer a two-year degree, a comparable two-year degree. So it can be a very expensive proposition.
And given that gap in the expense between mm-hmm. the traditional college and the for-profit college, what compels people to choose mm-hmm. the for-profit colleges? And is it merely, mm-hmm. to go back to your point about access, the fact that you can get into them and mm-hmm. attend them if you have the money to do so?
Yeah, we call that open enrollment, which is that there aren't any barriers to enrollment for things like your high school GPA or your score on the SAT or the ACT. Those things are not considered when you enroll at a for-profit college. Although there are open enrollment public and traditional colleges, there are more for-profits that operate as open enrollment. And so, yes, there is the fact that when you talk about 1 in 10 black college students are enrolled in for-profits, 1 in 14 Latino students, 1 in 14 first-generation college students are enrolled in for-profit colleges, those tend to be populations that have not been well-served by their K through 12 public school system. So I want to be very clear about that. This is not about a group of individuals who just happen to have a whole lot in common with each other, all choosing to attend for-profit colleges. I think there are real questions for us to ask about how well our K through 12 systems have prepared them to go to college, right? And what we see in the data is that you have a lot of students who graduated from high school without the requisite coursework to attend their local state university or traditional college. But the desire to go to college is still there.
Mm-hmm. I think that fact is often lost.
Absolutely.
When people are having this conversation.
Yes.
Because the assumption is that these people were not on a college track.
That's
they
right.
didn't have college aspirations. But that couldn't be farthest from the truth.
Yes, and college aspirations, very good phrase, because that is embedded within the conversation, the way we tend to frame it. Even in, we are now examining for-profit colleges in a way that we haven't in a very long time, if ever, because they have become so large and they make so much money. But even in that conversation, we do tend to lose sight of the fact, there's this assumption in that conversation that, oh, well, these were people who they're either making a choice that's best for them, you'll kind of hear that sort of line, or embedded in there is these weren't traditional, real college students. So,
And those assumptions are very deeply embedded with racial and class attitudes.
Yes.
About who's worthy of attending college, I
mm-hmm.
think, ultimately. This is WRFG, and we're in the midst of our pledge drive. If you're enjoying the conversation, please give us a call to make a pledge or make a secure online pledge at WRFG.org. The number in the studio is 404-523-8989. And if you're just tuning in, we are talking about what for-profit colleges are actually selling to their predominantly black and brown students. Do they offer the chance for upward mobility that they claim to sell? Now, mm-hmm. Tressie, I know that for several years you were an admissions mm-hmm. and financial aid counselor at a for-profit.
Yes.
Tell us more about your experiences in that capacity.
Oh, I will, and I this is not something that I speak about a lot, so let's let's get some practice doing that. Mostly because I had no intention of studying this when I came to graduate school, by the way. It is an issue that follows me more than I follow it, and I think it's important to point out. So I started out, I've worked in a couple of different parts of that sector, which I think gave me a pretty unique perspective. My very first job at a for-profit school was at a cosmetology school, which we don't tend to think of those as for-profit, but mm-hmm. almost all of them are. So it's an 18-month, career credential. By nature of it being a cosmetology school, it was almost all women. So I worked with a lot of women to enroll in the program. They were qualified to offer federal financial aid. As such, I got women from across the spectrum. One thing was pretty common among those women, however, is that almost all of them were using this as a way to better their immediate circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the women were of color or, although almost all of them, I would say overwhelmingly, they were black. but even for the few students I had who were not, there was this common thing about, you know, they were either escaping or trying to leave a relationship or had left one, and as such were trying to rebuild their lives. Almost all of them had children and were single parents, and we also see this in the greater for-profit population. How many of the women, over 70% of for-profit population are women, and among them, almost all of them tend to be single heads of households. So they're single moms, right? And this is very common in the cosmetology program. It was a fairly expensive credential at the time. It was about $12,000-$13,000. I didn't know much about for-profits when I started, didn't know the difference between them. I, like many people, had just gone away to college as a 17-year-old, right? Didn't know much difference. I learned about the sector through that program. And I have to say, I was not ashamed of the work that I did there. Even in retrospect, I am not. I saw young women change their lives by getting a cosmetology license, okay? It was a clear occupational outcome. They came in, they did the coursework, they passed the exam, and they were able to change their lives. By contrast, later on, I ended up going into a similar role at ITT Technical Institute, which has four-year degrees, bachelor's degrees, and master's degrees, the campus where I worked. And by contrast, it was an entirely different world for me. There was still overwhelmingly women and people of color in those programs, but I did not feel as good about their occupational outcomes as I had at the cosmetology school. Their enrollment practices were much more aggressive than I was comfortable with.
How so?
I think in the article that you mentioned earlier that I wrote, one of the clear-cut differences was in the way the admissions counselors were trained to enroll people based upon how they entered the school. So in for-profit colleges, very often one of the biggest differences is that you enroll by showing up. You don't fill out a college application and send it in. You make an appointment, you come in, and you speak to a counselor. If students showed up with their parents, for instance, you know, the admissions reps would say to each other before they go, oh, so, you know, they brought a parent or their parents. Let's do the quick sale. The expectation being that parents would ask harder, tougher questions, and that they would be more critical of the school and its offerings. So they wouldn't even try to close the sale, as you know, as they would if a young person or a potential student came in without a support network or without parents. Then the goal was to close the person that day, to have them enroll in school that day, to have their financial aid done by the end of the week. These were the goals that were set up for you
now,
by your manager.
I don't know anybody, and I went to a so-called traditional college, who got their financial aid processed in under a week.
Isn't that miraculous?
So there is something conspiratorial about this setup.
I will say that the speed with which they would move through the financial aid process is actually a bit enviable. But you are right. The idea was that to get the signatures as quickly as possible, right, because the signatures make it binding. And once it's binding, if we can get that butt in that seat and have them stay there for 2 weeks, the check from the federal government has cleared by that time. And then the process begins to be a lot less hands-on at that point. But the goal of the admissions counselor was to enroll the person that day, financial aid done at the end of a week, get their butt in the seats at the start of school,
whether
and
they
keep them
stay
there for 2 weeks.
Or not. So clearly, recruiting and enrolling minority students isn't the problem. But what about retaining and graduating them?
Mm-hmm.
And are there race and gender patterns
there
as well?
So we do see. I mean, so the overall pattern is that. It depends on what type of program you're enrolled in. So four-year degrees, meaning a bachelor's degree, the outcomes, students in the for-profit sector are less likely to graduate, more likely to drop out, less likely to graduate than our students in a traditional four-year program. The odds become a little better if they're in a two-year program, a certificate program, something like a cosmetology school. The retention rate is actually much better there than it is at a comparable traditional program, although that gets a little fuzzier when we talk about associate's degrees. And within that group, minorities or people that we say that have more risk factors. And one of those risk factors is being a single parent. So many black students tend to be more likely to be single parents, whether or not they're involved in any kind of federal welfare program, which a lot of for-profit students are. They have a lot more risk factors, and therefore the dropout rate tends to be much higher. So they have a lower retention rate than comparable traditional programs.
Well, now, how does this compare to the community college system, which also has a mandate to accept residents, state residents who apply, and so they may not be driven by the same kinds of admission standards as larger traditional colleges that are 4 years in their training. And we tend to think of community colleges for that reason as something of a social good, as institutions that do expand access, that do create opportunity. But for for-profit colleges, you seem to suggest that they don't necessarily help provide equal opportunity in education. So what's flawed about that argument as it pertains to for-profits?
Well, part of the flaw in that argument is that community colleges, like all of public higher education, has been severely defunded over the past 10 years. So yes, community colleges have for a very long time fulfilled that role within our society for those who did not want or need a four-year credential for their desired outcomes, or who needed retraining to rejoin the labor market or to make a change in careers. Community colleges have fulfilled that role for us for a very long time and have done a very good job of doing so. A new report, I just read this 2 days ago, so there is a new report showing that associate degrees from community colleges have a higher rate of return than do an associate's degree from a for-profit college, and are significantly cheaper. And we talked about tuition earlier. So a year at your the average tuition cost at a community college is about $7,000 a year. Again, compared to $18,000 to $20,000 a year at a for-profit college.
And the outcomes are better at community colleges,
and the
because
outcomes
of
are better.
Prestige, or
now that
what
gets
other
complicated. That's difficult to say. Whether it's prestige or whether or not the community colleges are very embedded within the local economies. I mean, community colleges are very place-based, right? So there's a certain amount of strength that comes with being a brick-and-mortar building that exists in the community and people know of it and have ties to that school. But I also would suggest, again, this is not based on data, but my personal experience, there's also, you know, you have support services at community colleges that for-profits may not mimic. Things like the writing center to help you with your writing in that first year course when you haven't been in school in a while. Math tutoring, career counselors. Your professors may be more available to you through office hours or, you know, to support you through community college. So I think it's probably a combination of those things.
We are drawing to the close of our time, but I did want to ask you another question as it relates to privatization. Privatization of everything.
Yes, yes.
Public
Which
utilities,
is exactly
services.
The way to say it. That's exactly what we're doing.
Well, you know, because where once there were so many things that were considered public goods, now it just seems as if it's just another thing for sale, and education has definitely fared no differently. So what's the logical outcome of this continuing commodification of education?
So education has been written into the American narrative as the way that everyone has equal opportunity, because one of the things we make clear in our narrative is that, no, everyone may not become wealthy in America, but everyone has an equal opportunity at becoming wealthy, right? And the main vehicle for that has always been education. When you remove the public incentive, the social good incentive from that, and it becomes a profit-motivated system, there is no way for us to ensure, to monitor the opportunity structure. There's no way for us to say that everyone has equal opportunity if the price tag for that opportunity is $25,000 a year. So,
and climbing.
And climbing. And I want to say that, you know, traditional colleges are kind of racing to the bottom to compete with for-profit colleges by privatizing some of their elements. And I think that that when we aren't critical of that, when we aren't clear about that, that is a problem. So the one thing that I hope to do, and I'm outgunned, and I'm out, this is a billion-dollar industry. Very often, on most days, I can see that I have probably already lost the fight, and that's
fine. We're not going to accept defeatist attitudes at WRFG.
Thank you. But I will say that the conversation at least needs to be had. We need to talk about education as a public good and not concede that. There's nothing wrong with being an ineffective system. Public higher education does not need to be efficient. It needs to be available.
Well, those are strong and powerful last words on a very interesting and very sobering topic. Chronic debt, unemployment, limited access to education.
It's
an ugly mixed bag that we're all selecting from. And as you say, education used to be a way out of all of our many fetters. Mm-hmm. And now it may be a big part of the problem. Tressie McMillan-Cottom, thank you so much. I understand you're organizing a conference on this subject.
Very quickly, what are some of the details?
Duke
University, September 21st and 22nd, for-profit access, opportunity, and for-profit higher education, thanks to a generous grant from the American Educational Research Association. You can find out more on my website, which is my name, Tressie MC. And honestly, you put Tressie in a Google search engine, I'm the only black person who comes up.
Tressie.
Correct.
Here on 89.3 WRFG. The number in the studio is 404-523-8989. We are in the midst of our pledge drive. Please call. Please call us and make your pledge today. What we offer here at WRFG is something entirely unique on the airwaves, and we have to keep it going and keep it strong.